The very biggest one is called the Euro, or the European Cup.
That happens every 4 years, and you qualify, just like you qualify for the World Cup, but it's only European teams. And this last go-round, Ukraine qualified for the tournament. Now, one of the things that happens before the tournament is you issue new jerseys. And so the jerseys come out, the badge tends not to change, but the design of the shirt does. And the Ukrainians put the outline of their country that included the occupied territory of Crimea, which the Russians claimed was theirs from 2014 on. And they did it on purpose to sort of send a message that this is ours, but also to make the Russians mad, which worked. It did make the Russians mad.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. My name is Lee Cooper, and I am an editor and science writer here at the University of Idaho, and I will be your host for today. And we are welcoming on for the first time to our podcast a new co-host. Danae, do you want to introduce yourself to everyone?
Hi, Lee. I'm Danae Lenz, and I'm the new External Communications Coordinator at U of I.
Well, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to bring you into this wonderful podcast.
I'm honestly really excited to be here. I'm going to be able to talk to a bunch of interesting people this season.
Excellent. All right. So speaking of interesting people and topics, we are covering an interesting intersection. We're talking today about international sports and international politics. So to start us off, I do have a question. Do you follow any sports, and do you have a team?
I do follow football, college football specifically. And I've been a longtime fan of the Nebraska Cornhuskers. But my love of football goes way back to me as a child. And so it's something I've carried with me for a very long time. Something super interesting that I've discovered since moving to Idaho is there's a lot of Nebraska fans out here. So it's really fun when I see people on the streets wearing a Nebraska hat or a Nebraska jersey or whatever, and we're like, hey, fellow Cornhusker, it's pretty cool.
Well, that leads me to one of the big points we're going to talk about today is the jerseys. We're going to talk about what those jerseys represent. So it sounds like at least you say there's definitely some camaraderie.
Absolutely.
When you see a jersey. What other things does the jersey mean to you? Like when you see one of these jerseys, what do you think about?
There's like a deep connection when you see someone, a complete stranger out there wearing something from a team that you love. It's like, I don't know you at all, but I want to be your best friend because we both like the same team, even if the team is terrible, as in the case of my team.
All right. So to walk us through the connection between international sports and international politics, will be Bill Smith. He's a professor and the director of the Martin Institute. He's going to take us on a trip around the world exploring examples of sports and where they were used to influence international politics. So you ready?
I'm ready.
Excellent. Hey, Bill. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast today.
Thanks, Lee. You know, I'm a fan of the Vandal Theory podcast. I think it's a neat way to get ideas and issues out there that are of interest to UI faculty and staff and hopefully to the public.
That's the goal. That's what we're hoping for. So can you introduce yourself real quick to our audience?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I'm Bill L. Smith. And when your name is Bill Smith, the middle initial is relevant because there's a few of us out there. I'm the director of the Martin Institute and the Bora Foundation, both of which are entities at UI endowed by donors that look at the causes of war, the conditions necessary for peace, and the international system. I really think I have the best job on campus.
I'm sure once we finish this podcast, a number of people will agree with you. Now, we are actually going to talk about an interesting intersection of topics. You have been studying international politics through the lens of sports. So how did you get interested in this overlap?
Well, for me, it was always there. We were a family that watched a lot of sports, but a lot of sports when I was growing. I was born in 1967, which means as I come of age, aware of things that are happening during the Cold War, and a lot of the sporting narratives that were international, not just sort of domestic messages, involved a sport, either competition between the United States and our allies with the Soviet Union and its allies, or individuals representing those regimes. And so television. We subscribed to Sports Illustrated. I read a couple of big newspapers every day. It was always around me. So it wasn't like I had to come to it. I was surprised everyone hadn't come to it before me.
I want to ask the kind of obvious question first. Is it possible to separate international sports and international politics?
So mostly it's not, but you can ignore it. So you can constantly choose to not really pay attention to the themes that are ongoing. Governments and non-governmental groups are using it all the time, either to get their message across or to use the opportunity for a sporting event to allow additional messages, not from the organizers, but from other people to get their messages across. So they'll be doing it all the time. Athletes will be involved in it often, but it certainly is possible for a fan to ignore it if they want to.
And today we are not going to ignore it. We're gonna spend a good 20 minutes talking about some examples. But first, I want to talk to you about, we're going to touch on a couple of sports, but for the most part, we're going to stick with soccer, which I know is dear to your heart and has manifested itself in an interesting collection. How many soccer jerseys do you have?
Well, I think I have the same answer to that any collector has about how many of the thing they have, which is not enough yet. But I've been collecting for about 30 years. So if you pick up about 5 jerseys a year, you end up with 150 jerseys hanging in the closet. So that's about what I have. Sometimes I buy some extras. I like to give them as prizes, and in exams or other events we have, I like to have a jersey to give out. And so I may get a few extras that aren't for me, but are for someone.
So I didn't ask that question just because it's cool that you have the collection. Where does the design of a jersey and politics come into play? There is an overlap.
There's a big overlap. And the reason I use soccer instead of other sports is because there's a concept called sports space that tries to determine what sport or sports can motivate a group of people or a whole country to act or interact or change their politics or change their belief system or do something. And the reason it works with soccer is because that sports space is replicated the most in the most places around the world. So it's different than something else would be.
Well, you hear the phrase, you know, soccer is a religion in so many countries.
Yeah, and people, when they say that, they're not being metaphorical, they're being literal. It's the ability to move you, like religion does. So it's not trying to be blasphemous to say it's the same as religion, but you're talking about that motivation to change how you act. So sports space, if it's in the sports space, you can get people to perhaps act differently than they might otherwise act if you use the sport or an athlete or an event in a certain way.
So talk to me, paint me a picture of these jerseys. I'm sure most people have seen one, but maybe they haven't looked closely. What are some of the literal parts of the jersey that we're going to talk about today?
So the two main parts are the colors and the badge. And so the badge is really a modern legacy of more ancient heraldry, where the coat of arms or the banner that's designed for someone or for some army has component parts that are trying to tell a story. And the story may be one about how great the ruler is and how they're actually the inheritor of some sort of mantle of leadership. Today, it's common symbology that's trying to convince a group of people that they belong together. And one of the things that's interesting about countries in the world is we're often accused or mentioned by people around the world that we're a young country, which is actually false. We're a very old country. We're a comparatively young culture. So whereas there's been in Italy for a relatively short time, there have been Italians for a very long time. But it's the country itself, the existence of it as the current unit that tends to be more recent. For example, concurrent German borders only exist from the early 1990s on. That's when there's been this current Germany, because you had East Germany and West Germany after World War II. That lasts about 45 years, and then they have to come together. So you need some common symbols to bring them together, and that the badge and the colors help with that.
So what are some other reasons? I mean, you're talking about bringing groups together that governments would get involved, or other examples of that?
Well, one of my favorites is Ghana, the West African nation of Ghana. Kwame Nkrumah, who was the first president of an independent Ghana. They became independent on January 1st, 1957, and where they had about 90 to 100 ethnic groups, different distinct languages, cultures, political practices, etc., that had had something in common, which was they wanted to get the British out and have an independent country. Once the British were out, they didn't have the same sort of commonality, and you had to create a nation out of whole cloth. There's a number of things that Kwame Nkrumah used. One of them he very consciously turned to was the formation of a national soccer team that had representatives from different national groups, ethnic groups, that could play under the symbol of the Black Stars. So the Ghanaian team is still called the Black Stars. Their jersey has a black star on it, and it's supposed to transcend those differences. And so that team is sent around to other nascent independent groups, independence movements around the continent as an example of what is possible. Because soccer is popular all around the continent, you can use this team as great outreach. I bumped into someone recently at the Vandal family lunch who was wearing a Ghana jersey. Got to go up and talk to him and, you know, be excited about the Black Star.
So it sounds like this does work in some cases.
It certainly can. And then you might not need the same symbols anymore. So another example would be the emergence of the Czech Republic as an independent nation in the mid-1990s. There had been people in the area we known as Czech Republic or Czechia now, they've changed their name formally recently, that had been part of Czechoslovakia, been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but there had been no independent, solely independent Czech Republic until the Czechoslovakia split into two. And so you did have people identified as Moravians, a sub-region of Czechia, as Silesians, and as Bohemians. And so they actually used the colors of the Czech flag, but then the symbols from those regions. And they're trying to get people to identify them as the same thing. Like, you from these places now belong to this new place. But after about 25 years or so, the symbols change because people identify with the Czech polity. So you don't need the alternate symbols anymore.
Does it ever not work?
So first, not every country that has jerseys and badges is trying to do that. Some are because they need that message. And sometimes the messaging is external. So you put something on your badge that's designed to tell other countries, this is something about us, and we're going to remind you of it when we show up at these tournaments.
So does it ever not work? Or, you know, that's they're not using it for that purpose?
Yeah, so they might not be using it for that purpose, or they might really not want other symbols. Because the symbols, so like in the Czech example, they're using an older version of identity from the region and bringing it forward. Some regimes, they're worried about alternate identities. And so you find countries that have dictatorships or less freedom, where they really want to identify with the current regime, they don't want to have alternate symbols. So the North Koreans, for example, only play under the North Korean flag. The badge is the flag. And so many countries do that. Cuba did it under Fidel Castro. It's loosened up afterwards. They didn't really want to have an alternate identity that people said, hey, we don't have to follow this regime because we have this other narrative as well. China has recently changed. They played only under the flag of the People's Republic of China until Xi Jinping, who's the current president. He also happens to be a big soccer fan, and he wants to promote Chinese soccer. And you can't really sell jerseys that have the Chinese flag on it. People don't like to wear it outside China. So they use a dragon now that does have an alternate identity. But, you know, you've got cultural symbols in China that go back thousands of years. It's easy to find one to bring forward. It's whether you want to or not is the question.
So it seems to me like that would get very complicated when, I mean, quite a few of these countries have, you know, very established club leagues with rivalries or national leagues that play. Does it ever get complicated when they're trying to bring people together to work on the international stage?
Yeah, especially with the club game, because the clubs, depending on where you're at in the context, so this is not going to explain every situation, but clubs often come to represent sub-regions. So, for example, a very famous soccer club called FC Barcelona, which is in the Catalan region of Spain, they're a club team in a national league, more like you would see the Seattle Seahawks or the Utah Jazz, right? They're a club team. So in this case, then, on their badge, they have the colors of Catalonia, and the fans often fly the Catalan flag because it's part of the jersey, but that is definitely not a pro-Spain flag. And there's been independence movements and separatist movements in Catalonia that can be forwarded by the identity with the soccer team and the jersey and the badge.
What about, I mean, I know in some places there's, like you said, there's regional pride, but there can also be examples of like indigenous pride, or like, are there examples like that?
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I like soccer jerseys is because my grandfather was the president of the Clan MacArthur for North America, the Scottish clan, with our Scottish heritage. We have other heritages as well. We're admixtures of lots of different Northern and Western European peoples. But the Scotland had qualified for the 1986 World Cup, and that was neat. But I hadn't really been aware at the time that there is no independent Scotland. Like, I know we say Scotland, we say England, we use them sometimes as synonyms for the United Kingdom or for Great Britain, but they're actually not the same thing. And so there are in both indigenous groups and certain subnational groups that have rights in sports that don't exist anywhere else. So for me, the idea that there was a Scotland was great. Finding out that there's only a Scotland in a national sense in three sports was revelatory to me. And so that the jersey mattered, because that was a place you could be Scotland. So it comes from a concept called a cultural hearth. If you are the originator of a sport, you get special rights to have a national team. So you may not have a nation, an independent nation state recognized at the United Nations, but you have a national team in sport. So another example for that would be Hawaiians, who get to have a separate national team for surfing, because that's the cultural hearth of surfing. Or the Iroquois Nationals in the sport of lacrosse, because they're the originators of that game. So if you go to an international competition for lacrosse, you very well might see the Iroquois national team competing right alongside an England team. And neither one of those are independent countries, but they are in certain sports.
And yet, does it become contentious when you do things like the Olympics?
You've never seen the Iroquois in the Olympics. We have natives in the Olympics, like Native Americans can qualify and go. One of the clips that I pull up regularly to watch is Billy Mills winning a race in the Tokyo Olympics. It's as thrilling as it could be. He was a Siouan runner for the United States. Those are only recognized in those sports, and the Olympics recognizes Olympic teams, and the Olympics and the sporting federations overlap, but you have to have access to the Olympics to have your sport gain access to the Olympics. So there is no England at the Olympics. There's a Great Britain. There is no Hawaii at the Olympics. There's a USA. So if you're a Hawaiian surfer and you want to go to the Olympics in Tokyo in 2020, 2021, after COVID was the first time surfing was a gold medal sport, the Hawaiian athletes had to choose to not go because they want to represent Hawaii, or to go as part of the United States.
Oh, I can see where that would be a hard choice for those athletes.
And we had Hawaiian athletes make the opposite choice. So you have some very good surfers who said, I'm not going to go because I'm Hawaiian, and I won't go until I can go as Hawaii. And you'll never be able to go as Hawaii because there's the way the Olympic structure works. You won't get that access. And others who say, yeah, I'm going to show how great Hawaii is by winning the gold medal for the United States.
So moving in a slightly different direction, can sports be used as a bridge for political purposes?
Yeah, so but it equally works for the opposite, right? So we get excited about these examples of détente, where you use sports sort of conscientiously to build a relationship, to heal rifts. But those work the best when there's low stakes, or there's no medal or spot in a final at stake, or where one team is competing in a sport that they're very good at and that matters in their country, and the other isn't. So you can be good athletes in both. We haven't had formal diplomatic relationships in the United States with Iran since 1979, but our wrestlers get together all the time, and our wrestlers travel to Iran. Wrestling matters in Iran, and we have great wrestlers. So our athletes can win a match in Iran, and the Iranians are happy still, because the United States then is not touting that as a victory for the United States. It's sort of a safe place where we can be friends again. So that's a detente. Now, if you did that, so if Iran is drawn to compete against an Israeli in the Olympics, they're commanded by their sporting structure and their politicians to forfeit, to feign injury, and to not compete with the Israelis, to not give that recognition to Israel as an independent nation. So there's one. It's the same country doing different things with the sport, either to bring folks together or to drive them apart.
Wow, that's impressive. I didn't know that.
judo at the Olympics and at competitive things, that's one where both Israeli athletes and Iranian athletes are very good. And there was an Iranian athlete about 3 years ago who refused to throw the match, and he had to leave Iran and defect and go to Germany because he was not supposed to compete. So one of my favorite examples of a symbol coming to matter through sport is the emergence of the maple leaf as a Canadian symbol, which had been actually existed about 6 or 7 years before this example. But when it was worn by the Canadian hockey team in something called the Summit Series in the early 1970s, this was a series of hockey games that were hosted in Canada and in the Soviet Union between two of the great hockey powers. This was supposed to promote friendship and unity between the two peoples. But instead, the stakes were too high, things mattered too much, and they became very contentious, and lots of bad blood developed, particularly on the side of the Canadians. But people go crazy in Canada for the maple leaf symbol that's on the jersey, that is also on the flag, but then comes to mean more because it was on the jersey in this this event.
Yeah, those are two countries that are not going to not care about hockey.
Right, right. But it was a good idea. So they say, this is going to promote friendship, but the stakes were too high. So it doesn't really work.
Does it ever just totally not work because nobody cares about sports?
So you could have that. So first you can have regimes that don't bow to any pressure. Oftentimes the regime still might try to use sports. So one example would be North Korea. I mentioned them a little bit earlier. They claim sporting greatness and they like to promote themselves as the regime as super talented. Whether the teams can perform at that level or not is a separate question. They're using sport to try and get a message across about how successful the regime is. But when they interfere in things, for example, after the 2010 World Cup, they had talked about them being able to win the tournament. They're actually out in the first round. They're in a very tough group, so it's not surprising. But the regime, the North Korean regime, calls the coach and the players before them and berates them for hours, fires the coach, makes them a field laborer. The players don't get to play anymore. And so then when the sporting federations say, you know what, we're not going to let you play anymore, they're like, fine. We can't pressure them to change through sport. We can't pressure the Russians. Like right now, we're really leveraging trying to get the Russians to get out of Ukraine and to get their politicians out, their government out of doping their athletes to improve their performance in sport. But right now, then, sports really matters to the Russians, but they're not responding to the pressure. Part of it is that there's no way for the country, the citizenry, to respond because it's not a democracy. So they can't say, you know what, we miss being in sports, so we're going to vote you out. It's both that the regime can resist it and that there's no avenue for the populace to rebel in that way.
Do countries ever use the soccer jersey to, basically pour salt in a wound?
Yeah. So one of my very favorite ones, just mentioned Russia and Ukraine. There are not just World Cups, but there's all kinds of age level World Cups. So you have the full tournament, under 23, under 20, under 17, under 15. But then they also have regional tournaments. So those could be the East African Cup, the African Cup, the Arab Cup. So these teams can play in a variety of these. The very biggest one is called the Euro or the European Cup. That happens every 4 years and you qualify, just like you qualify for the World Cup, but it's only European teams. And this last go round, Ukraine qualified for the tournament. Now, one of the things that happens before a new tournament is you issue new jerseys. And so the jerseys come out, the badge tends not to change, but the design of the shirt does. And the Ukrainians put the outline of their country that included the occupied territory of Crimea, which the Russians claimed was theirs from 2014 on. And they did it on purpose to sort of send a message that this is ours, but also to make the Russians mad, which worked. It did make the Russians mad. And so there's others like that where they're putting some symbols on to try and throw that external message out.
Do you have a favorite jersey?
I do. So normally you'd say no because they're all my favorites. It's all my children, my shirts. I have a favorite, and it's on our Armenian national team jersey. And it's my favorite for a variety of reasons, one of which the alum who brought it back for me from the Armenian Football Federation, Ruben Sarukian, brought it to me. And so that matters, that connection matters. He got it personalized with an Armenian player who I like a lot, named Yurim Avsisian. But the jersey itself also has on the badge one of my favorite symbols on any shirt. And it's in the middle of the badge is a picture of waves with a mountain coming above it. The mount is Mount Ararat. and a thing on top of the mountain. The thing is Noah's Ark. And the idea that they have put this sort of legacy, which is common to three major religions, right? That's Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all share that idea. But Mount Ararat physically is just over the Armenian border in Turkey. The relationship between Turkey and Armenia going way back is not good. Turkey committed a genocide in Armenia in the 1910s and early 20s. And so that's a message that's internal, like we're proud of this, but also, hey, that's ours. That's actually ours. That cultural legacy is Armenian, not Turk. So that combination of things, my friend and colleague, Ruben, the player, the badge, that's my favorite one.
All right, we're coming up on it now. Any last kind of take-home message for our listeners?
So one of the things that I have fun with this is you can offer a class on sport and international affairs that uses sport as a hook, because sport is in everything and everything is in sport. So yes, it's possible to just ignore and enjoy great achievements and great accomplishments. My favorite thing that happened this decade outside of my own personal connection of life is a Qatari athlete and an Italian athlete sharing the gold medal in the high jump in 2021. And that idea that they could bridge the cultural gap, that they could see a way through competition, like that kind of thing will be there and will be wonderful. But once you've taught everyone about this, it is easy to see it all around you for the rest of your life. So the themes come back. It doesn't just exist like in a classroom at the University of Idaho when you were 20. When you're 60, you'll be like, oh yeah, I know what's going on here. I recognize this. I see the theme. And that's great fun to me.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming on today.
You're welcome, Lee. Cheers.
Well, Danae, what did you think?
It was extremely interesting. As a fan of sports, I just loved how deep he got into things and triggered some things in my mind that I never would have thought of before. The number one thing that stood out to me was how sports, even among rival nations, if the stakes are low, then it can be a way to build friendship. But when he was talking about Canada and Russia competing in the 70s, there was no way that that would ever be friendly. Those two...
Absolutely impossible.
Yes.
Hockey?
Yes, absolutely impossible. So that just really stood out to me. I'd never thought of that before, and it makes total sense.
Oh, absolutely. For me, it was just, it's the fact that, I mean, yes, he mentioned that as a viewer, maybe you can distance yourself, but for the players, for the nations, like anytime you're on a national stage, nothing doesn't bring with it extra meaning. I mean, we're going down to the jersey logos, which have no bearing on how good a team is and how they play or anything like that. And yet that's the level that people play politics at.
Mm-hmm.
And just how we had, you know, example after example of how people use this level of play to get their message across, whether to their own people or to outside nations. It was so many examples. I could have listened to him for another hour, go through example after example. I had to pull so many just to fit in our time frame.
I believe it. He seems like he has a lot of stories and a lot of information to go off of.
If there's a story for every jersey he owns, we could have gone on for hours.
There probably is.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website, uidaho.edu, at Vandal Theory, for more about our research across our university. You can email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu. And please check us out. We're on most podcasting platforms out there. We'd love it if you'd rate and review, and even more, we'd love it if you'd subscribe. I'm Lee Cooper.
I'm Danae Lenz.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.